Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath, Debbie Brook, with Dr. Otto Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today is February 13th, 2013. Show number 52. Must be a full year we've been working together with co-host Dr. Adil Kasim, MD, fourth generation homeopath, and my teacher, my guru, and I hope he's yours too. So we're going to be continuing with part two of opening our handy resource book, The Repertory, that is written by Dr. James Tyler Kent, and open up to the chest chapter. That's, we're doing eruptions. But first, he's going to introduce a few other masters in homeopathy to us this morning. Well, to me it's this morning. To you it might be nighttime. I think he's here with us. Are you able to hear? How's your sound? Okay, so maybe there's a little glitch with the sound. Oh, you know what? Somebody called in with a 410 number. And now I see that Dr. Adil is with us. So folks who have signed in today, it's possible when you're on Blog Talk Radio to listen to the show just on the website. And you can call in if you want to ask a question or make a comment to 347-945-6956 or via Skype. There's a little blue button on the Blog Talk Radio Homeopathy World Community page. And I also invite you to go to Homeopathy World Community. We have a whole section there, a group, dedicated to the archives of these shows where there may be some written material or a handout. And for this show, there is a handout where you'll be able to view illustrations of skin disease and associated remedies. So thank you very much, and we're going to get started today. Good day, Dr. Adil.
Hi, how are you, Debbie?
I'm doing great.
And what quote do we have today to start up?
What quote do we have? Oh, I do have a quote, actually. I just have to find where I put it. It's it's on Facebook. And if you folks are following us on Facebook, on Homeopathy World Community, I have two quotes, perhaps. One is by Margaret Shepherd, which says, "Sometimes your only available transportation is a leap of faith." You know, when you have that chasm before you, and
exactly,
you're just not going to make it yourself, and then you actually need to let go and of the fear or whatever it is that's holding you back, and let God take you across to the other side.
And sometime in life, I think one has to leave things to God.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are times when you realize that certain situations are not under your control. And then this situation comes when you have to just leave and let go.
Yes. And the second one, the second quote, which actually goes beautifully with the first one, comes from Nelson Mandela, and this one is also on Facebook. It says, quote, "It always seems impossible until it's done."
How true.
Yes.
And every time, I mean, before starting this series of show, starting the interview, I felt, how is it possible? How am I going to give an interview with a person sitting right in U.S. seven seas across? And then once you started, it's nearly 1.5 years over, and we have been giving an interview. And successfully, the show is going on.
It's getting better each time, and our sound is good, and your connection is good, and we must have some spirit behind us.
Exactly, and the audience is also building up. So that gives us a great impetus to continue the show and make it much better.
Yes, people have been contacting you, asking you questions due to the show's presence online, and hopefully we'll have some more of those in the future. So don't forget, you can contact Dr. Adil at homeoacad.org, is it?
Yeah, is it? It is, sorry, to ORG.
Yes, and also, I also had an incredible experience this morning. For me this morning, my brother sent me a message, and if no one has ever heard of Jackie Evancho, I will be putting up a post about her. This is a little girl who has the voice of a seasoned opera singer. She is now 13, and she has sung everywhere with every famous opera singer. I'm sure she will at some time, and it is as if the voice of heaven has come down to earth. It's truly amazing. I will be sending some links about that.
Our best wishes to this little girl. Hope
yes.
She does wonders in her life.
She already has. Okay, so on Homeopathy World Community, there is part one where you can refresh and see the original show from last week. And there is a handout with that for PDF, chest eruptions, and you can follow along. So we're going to begin with study about masters, I believe.
Well, yeah. There are two masters who deserve tributes. One is Dr. Carl Casperi, and the other is Dr. Carol Dunham. Dr. Carl Casperi, I don't know the exact date of birth, but he was born in 1798, and he left for Heavenly Abode on 15th of February, 1828. This gentleman was the son of a village priest and a grandson of Professor D. Snott from Delish. He graduated from Leipzig. He delivered a course of lectures on practical surgery to students of Leipzig. He was fascinated by homeopathy and relinquished a bright future easily accessible to him in any famous school of surgery. He published My Observations upon Homeopathy. Since he had excellent relations with the important physicians of allopathy as well as homeopathy, he attempted to reconcile the two doctrines and tried to propagate an amalgamation between the two systems. But during the later part of his life, he left this idea and became a zealous homeopath. He also had a special study of electricity in connection with homeopathy, homeopathic therapeutics, and spoke highly of the healing powers of electricity. At some time, I believe in 1826, Hahnemann and two men were living. Whose premature death was a sad loss to homeopathy. For both were gifted men, and their works testify the powers of mind, such as the Creator entrusts to but a few. I refer to Dr. Casperi and Dr. Hartlove, Senior. This was what Dr. Hartmann wrote about Casperi. I quote again. Two men were living whose premature death was a sad loss to homeopathy, for both were gifted men and their works would testify the powers of mind such as the Creator entrusts to but few. Hartmann describes Casperi's characters as, I quote, not quite accessible by everyone, unquote, and possessed of an insufferable haughtiness which seemed to be based upon a fancy that he was exalted above all others. Is this a compliment or not? I don't know. Well, Casperi's contributions are many. Well, reading about Kasperi, I came to know that he proved Carbo-Veg before Hahnemann.
Hmm.
A very, very important drug which we use left, right, and center in cardiology, and that is Carbo-Veg, Carbo-Vegetabilis. And he proved, Kasperi proved Carbo-Veg before Hahnemann. He also wrote a book, My Experience in Homeopathy, An Unprejudiced Estimation of Hahnemann's System, which was published as early as 1823. Hartmann observed, I quote, "And who knows whether by his proving of Carbo-Veg, he might not have excited Hahnemann to undertake the proving of both the charcoals. I am not quite positive as regards this last fact, but remember that Hahnemann was at one time quite angry at Kasperi and cannot tell whether it was because he was always displeased with those who anticipated him." Well, these are all, it's Hartmann's observation about Hahnemann and Kasperi. But what is more important was proving of Carbo-Veg by Kasperi being the first. Well, many homeopathic writings have been written by this great gentleman. In 1823, as I said, An Unprejudiced Estimation of Hahnemann's System. In 1825, he wrote a book on Handbook of Dietetics for All Ranks, arranged according to homeopathic principles. I have never read this book. I hope to read it one day. In 1826, he wrote Homeopathic Domestic and Traveler's Physician. In 1834, he wrote another wonderful volume about homeopathic pathology, also under the title Library for Homeopathic Medicine and Materia Medica. All these books were published in Leipzig. And further in 1823, he wrote Injuries to the Head and the Treatment from the Oldest Times to the Present with New Ideas and a Treatise on Inflammation. And 1824, System of Surgical Dressings, systematically arranged and reduced to a science. So, really, he has given a lot to homeopathy. Dr. Karl Kasperi left us on 15th of Feb, 1828, and we pay homage to this great soul. Another wonderful gentleman, a homeopath, a noted homeopath in of his times, and of course, whose writings we still endure, that is Dr. Carol Dunham. He was born on 29th of October, 1828, and he died on 18th February, 1877. For him, it is said, the memory of this great and good man is enshrined in the work he accomplished on earth, as well as in the hearts of all who came within the circle of his wise and helpful benevolence. Very high words for a great man. Carol Dunham was born, as I said, on October 29, 1828 in New York. He was the youngest of the four sons of Mr. Edward Wood and Mrs. Maria Dunham. His mother died at the age of 4 years, when Carol was only 4 years old, because of a cholera epidemic. As a child, he was markedly docile, cheerful, and bright boy, and was very particular about the feelings of others. Although he was a very healthy child, but he avoided the rough sports and was described by his elder brother as always looking into things with an eager desire to know all about their qualities and uses. Well, this quality is true with all other great souls. Inquisitiveness and something new, a desire to learn something new. Well, Carol graduated with honors from Columbia College in 1847 and then commenced the study of medicine. In 1850, he received his MD from the College of Physicians and Surgeons, then located in the Crosby Street of New York. Conversion to homeopathy, he was cured of a serious and dangerous malady in which the best allopathic treatment failed and was subsequently cured by a homeopath. This impressed him and his father. He started reading the homeopathic literatures and comparing homeopathic result with that of allopathy. His findings impressed him further. After completing his studies, he went to Philadelphia to see Dr. Constantine Herring, who was then the high priest of homeopathy in USA. He learned much about homeopathy and, moreover, in his own words, gained the most helpful, generous, and genial friend ever made. He went to Paris and came in contact with many eminent allopathic physicians like Bolliard, Velpau, Toucy, and he regularly visited the homeopathic hospital under the guidance of Dr. Tessier. From Paris, he went to Berlin and then to Vienna, where he remained several months, attending to the hospital clinics of Wurmb and the lectures of Casper on Materia Medica. Then he went to Montar to visit Boninghausen, who received him cordially and in turn was impressed with Dr. Dunham's industry and intelligence. He prophesied a bright future for this young Carol. Dr. Dunham remained there long enough to see numerous cases being cured by the distinguished old guard and could observe his method of examining the patient and prescribing for them. He literally and liberally availed himself with the foreign culture and education. Dr. Dunham turned his steps towards his homeland thereafter. After returning back to US, he started his practice in Brooklyn. Very soon, he acquired fame for his behavior and care of the patient. His ability and success were so marked that Dr. P.P. Wells, an esteemed friend and family physician of the Dunham family, said, quote, "He was always like my friend and never my pupil," unquote. Due to severe illness, he had to change his residence to New Brough, New York, from Brooklyn in 1858. And this gentleman passed away on February 18, 1877, because of a feeble health and overstrain. He was bedstricken on December 2, 1876. And from 1876 to 1877, he remained in his house. And on his death, Dr. Jocelyn wrote, quote, "Though his death was obviously caused by exhausted vitality, consequent on his labors in connection with the World's Homeopathic Convention, and though the nervous system must be looked upon as the main seat of trouble, still the mind remained clear to the last and was never clouded during any period of illness," unquote. Dr. P.P. Wells also said that, quote, "He died of no disease, but from exhaustion produced by excessive and protracted labor," unquote. So, in contributions, there are about 5 to 7 pages of contributions, which I can't go. So, my tributes and homages to this great soul, and that is Dr. Carol Dunham.
Thank you very much. I wonder how those physicians would feel if they were living today. It sounds like they had close relationships with their contemporaries and in their work, and to imagine how they
Quite unlike the present times, because nowadays, egos rule the roost.
Well,
many people don't have good relations with each other. Many people in their own fields don't have. And it's very sad to note that, but then it's quite true.
I was thinking it the other way around. I was thinking that with the internet and the fact that we can reach out across the ocean, that they would have developed so many more relationships with contemporaries. I was thinking positively about that. And I mean, just the fact that you and I are sitting at the, you know.
Exactly. Well,
so, okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
That is true. Before we start on with our chest chapter and the rubric of eruptions, two questions, quick questions I would like to answer. Quite good questions. First question is from Dr. Prashant Khaddev from a place called Wardha in India. And he says, "Sir, I've come across the remedy hypothalamus, but can't find the details of its proving in any of the books. Kindly describe this remedy in short."
Hypothalamus?
Yeah, hypothalamus.
Okay.
So, well, whatever I could get hold of hypothalamus, I've never used hypothalamus, but then it was first proved by Dr. H. Vanier of Rouen, R-O-U-E-N. The mother tincture was obtained from hypothalamus of a bull. The following are the keynote symptoms of this remedy, Dr. Prashant. Please note down. A. Extremely sensitive and loving nature. Morbid fear or irresistible attraction to the opposite sex. Indecisive. So probably it's a drug of choice for nymphomania. Second, occipital headaches with sadness aggravated in the evening. Third, hypothyroidism with obesity and water retention. Very good. A very, very common symptom which we find nowadays with metabolic disorders, and that is obesity and water retention. Hopefully, hypothalamus should work. Obstinate constipation. Crude food or sweets are not tolerated well. Crude food or sweets are not tolerated well.
And what does this mean, crude?
Fruit means salads, for example.
Okay, just like uncooked.
Yeah, uncooked food. So crude food or sweets are not tolerated well. Acrocyanosis. That means cyanosis of the extremities. Not even extremities, the fingers and the toes. That is called acrocyanosis, aggravated by cold. And this acrocyanosis is quite frequently seen physiologically in cold climates when the temperature suddenly becomes very cold and you expose if your hands and feet are, which is also called a snow bite. Or else, you can also see it in Raynaud's phenomena. Raynaud's phenomena or Raynaud's disease is arterial vasospasm, arterial spasm because of cold. And it can occur in Berger's disease also, wherein you can have sustained arterial spasm, thereby leading to cyanosis and eventually, if nothing is done, then to gangrene. So acrocyanosis aggravated by cold, another very good remedy for acrocyanosis, to my mind, is agaricus.
Yes.
But I never knew that hypothalamus also has got this symptom. The next symptom is cough aggravated in lying position. The other remedies would be spongia, hyoscyamus, drosera. Cough aggravated by lying position. Please correct, I'm sorry. Cough aggravated by lying position and ameliorated by sitting up. Like calicab and arsenic as breathlessness is concerned. But this is cough. Cough aggravated by lying position and ameliorated or better in sitting up. Asthma after suppression of menses. Very good. Menses irregular, profuse and in clots with severe dysmenorrhea. The author has not described what sort of dysmenorrhea. That means, for example, in Sabina we have got pain from back to pubes. So likewise, the author has not described, it only describes severe dysmenorrhea, so pain during menses. But the menses are irregular, profuse and in clots. Leucorrhea during ovulation. Now, to my mind, there is a disease called as PCOD, that is polycystic ovarian disease syndrome. Now in polycystic disease ovarian syndrome, it occurs in young girls and wherein you have got multiple cysts in the ovaries and it presents as menses irregular, profuse and in clots and with severe dysmenorrhea, leucorrhea during ovulation. It also presents as frontal alopecia in young girls, which is another symptom of hypothalamus. It also presents as obesity and water retention. It also presents as obstinate constipation. So, all in all, hypothalamus can be a wonder drug for patients of PCOD, that is polycystic ovarian disease syndrome, wherein practically all the symptoms which you get in PCOD are also described in the proving of hypothalamus.
And in such a case, do you do something like a 3-ax, a 6-ax, or a mother tincture? What do you do?
Well, since I have never used hypothalamus myself, I have only got it from the books. So, I can't comment. But then the proving symptoms, I would believe that instead of giving 3-ax and 6-ax, why not give it as a centesimal scale, potency, ascending scale? Suppose if you get a patient of, say, PCOD or hypothyroidism having all these features and he or she is not responding to a particular line of treatment or a particular medicine, then one should start with, to my mind, hypothalamus, start with 30 low potency and repeated ascend potency to 200, 1m, 10m till you find a substantial relief of symptoms, both symptomatically as well as pathologically, that means the biochemical parameters as well as the investigative parameters like USG also show significant results. So, of course, Dr. Prashant did ask me about hypothalamus, but it has opened my eyes to this remedy too. So, hopefully, the Department of Gynecology can use, and I will ask the Department of Gynecology if they can use hypothalamus, and hopefully, in times to come, in months or 2 months, we get lots of cases, so we have got good scope of usage of this remedy. The only thing is we have not used it. So first of all, we have to find out whether hypothalamus is available in India in any potency or not. And if available, then we would use it. And then surely I'll get back to you in 2 or 3 months with our experience of hypothalamus.
Well, I think that some of the pharmacies, they have combination remedies, which include this particular essence of the hypothalamus. When they do glandulars, then they mix them up, and I believe you could probably find it at something like Helios. I also want to remind the listeners that this show is educational, a study session, and if you are having health concerns, you need to see your own professional practitioner.
Exactly. I mean, we are discussing about, we are giving information, and much of the information is proved, our own experience, much is from the literature. All in all, it's an information, and information need not be directly applied just by listening, but it should be verified by technical people. Well, the second question is from Pratibha Dangre from my own city, Nagpur, and she says, what is chronic atrial fibrillation? Please give names of a few remedies for managing it. She has asked me this question about 4 to 5 times, and that is the reason why I have to take it in one of the shows. So I'm taking it. Pratibha, of all the arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation is the most frequently encountered and sustained cardiac arrhythmia in a clinical practice. Even here at my practice, atrial fibrillation is the commonest arrhythmia which I find. So by definition, it is a supraventricular tachycardia. Supra means above the ventricle, supraventricular tachyarrhythmias. That means a rhythm disorder which is very fast, more than 120 beats per minute in an average adult. So supraventricular tachyarrhythmia. So by definition, this is a supraventricular tachyarrhythmia characterized by the presence of uncoordinated atrial activation and deteriorating atrial mechanical function. The atria is basically a collecting chamber in which the blood collects. From the atria, the blood flows to the ventricle. From the right atria to the right ventricle, the left atria to the left ventricle. It just gives a slight push. It does not even contract fully. So it gives a slight push, this atrial muscle. So the only mechanical action which the atria is there is giving a slight push. So even if that fails, and atria basically works as a whole, both the right and left atria work as a whole, and on the ECG or electrocardiogram, you see the presence of atrial functioning as a P wave, a single P wave. So a single P wave is there, but suppose if the atrial muscles are working independently of each other, then you have got an uncoordinated atrial activation, and this causes a chronic atrial fibrillation. So this chronic atrial fibrillation, although very common, can be typified or classified as follows. One, it may be a recurrent paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. Recurrent paroxysmal, that paroxysmal means sudden onset. A recurrent paroxysmal atrial fibrillation means sudden onset, self-terminating episodes of atrial fibrillation, usually lasting less than 48 hours. So within 48 hours, the episode subsides. And many people after the age of 45 or 50 years, they do get one or two attacks of recurrent paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, but that need not be recurrent. If it's recurrent, then we call it as chronic atrial fibrillation. Then there's something called as persistent atrial fibrillation. That means once the atrial fibrillation starts, it is persistent. An episode of sustained atrial fibrillation, usually greater than 7 days, that does not convert to sinus rhythm without either a pharmacological or electrical cardioversion. So 7 days, if the atrial fibrillation is continuing, then it is called as a persistent atrial fibrillation. And the third variety is a long-standing persistent atrial fibrillation pertains to atrial fibrillation with duration of 1 year or longer, where a decision has to be taken to implement a rhythm control strategy. And lastly, we have got a permanent atrial fibrillation. Is atrial fibrillation accepted as long-term rhythm for that person? So this was, in short, the classification of a chronic atrial fibrillation. Mind you, audience, this is a technical issue, but still, if a person has asked me this question, I need to address it. As far as the homeopathic management of this ailment is concerned, it depends upon the presenting symptomatology. Many times, rather in maximum patients, atrial fibrillation does not have symptoms to prescribe upon. But the most common symptom that such patients may experience are palpitations. One, second, it could be anxiety in the region of chest. Third, it can be irregular fluttering sensation in the chest. Sometimes you can have lightheadedness, particularly when you are suddenly getting up or squatting or going down the stairs, so you can have lightheadedness. You may just feel lack of energy or breathlessness with effort. A separate rubric is given in the chapter of pulse. When you see the generalities chapter in Ken's repertory, you will have a rubric of pulse, and the pulse, fast, intermittent, irregular. There's a separate rubric, pulse, fast, intermittent, irregular, which can be taken if the patient only has electrocardiogram findings but no symptoms. Hello, are you there, Debbie?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, I got one beep. I know someone has asking questions, or I don't know.
You're doing good. I just sent you a Skype message.
Okay. Sorry. Then we have got the most of the patients who are under our care are already pre-diagnosed on digitalis or beta blockers. I mean, they come from allopathic school and they are on digitalis some dose, or they may be on beta blockers like atenolol or nebulol, anything else. So once they're hemodynamically stable, we gradually taper off these drugs and start Viscomalb. At least in our center, Viscomalb is a very, very important remedy and low potency till the drug is completely stopped. So if you have to withdraw the patient from digitalis or beta blockers, allopathic beta blockers and digitalis, then Viscomalb in low potencies, 1x, 2x or 3, at the most 3x. You may need to give it daily, on a daily basis, or twice a daily, depending upon the symptomatology as well as the arrhythmias the patient is presenting with. If there are good amount of physical and mental genitals, then a constitutional drug is administered with proper dose and repetition. And in some patients, it becomes necessary to continue the so-called pathological simulimum. This Viscomalb is a pathological simulimum, even after giving the constitutional remedy. So, I believe, although it's a very technical issue, but still, people would have understood what is a chronic atrial fibrillation. And, of course, the remedy hypothalamus, which Dr. Prashant wanted to know.
Those are great hints. And for those who are studying homeopathy, I hope you are taking some notes because you want to refer back to them to set them in your mind.
Well, coming back to our original talk, and that is where we are discussing the rubric eruptions from the chest chapter of the Ken's repertory. And we started on by learning about blotches, what a blotch is. And I just repeated in short that the various types, dermatologists categorize skin eruptions as a macule, a papule, and so on. A macule is a discoloration on the skin. It is at the level of the skin, but not exceeding greater than 2 centimeters. If it is greater than 2 centimeters, then it is called as a patch. And if it is red in color, it is called as a blotch. If it is raised above the skin, but less than 2 centimeters, it is called as a papule. If the papule increases in size to more than 2 centimeters, then it is called as a nodule. If it is more than 5 centimeters, this nodule is called as a tumor. So, tumor is a solid elevation above the skin greater than 2, on the skin, greater than 2, 5 centimeters. If the solidness is replaced by liquid, then it is called as a vesicle. If the liquid is replaced by pus, it is called pustule or an abscess. If it is replaced by blood, then it is called as a blister. So these are different terminologies for describing eruptions, so blotches. And I have taken references from Ken's repertory. If you are on the PowerPoint presentations, you can see that Ken's repertory, apart from Ken's repertory, we have also taken help of Homeopathic Repertory by Robin Murphy, Homeopathic Materia Medica by J.T. Kent, Clark's Materia Medica, we have Materia Medicas of Nash, Allen, Borick, and Lilienthal Therapeutics. All these I took so that we could effectively describe what certain drugs are can be. Now, the next slide was blotches, and the sub-rubrics of blotches are not given in Ken's repertory, they are given in repertory of Robin Murphy. Still, I have enlisted them. Indurated blotches, inflamed blotches, blotches with itching, wherein graphitis is a 5-mark drug. Livid blotches, that means there's a pale, initially bluer, but then followed by a very pale yellowish colored blotch. Red blotches, desquamating blotches, elevated blotches, scratching after, stinging, watery yellow. So all these are sub-rubrics, I can't go in depths. Then we describe blisters, and the commonest cause of blisters which we see in children is because of impetigo contagiosa. Impetigo contagiosa is a bacterial infection which generally occurs in monsoon in the developing countries or in places near the equator. We have got monsoon, and as the rains start, that is in the month of June, July and August, we've got lots of children less than 12 years presented with numerous blisters, and they are called as impetigo contagiosa. It's by a bacteria called as group A beta hemolytic streptococci, or it can be because of Staphylococcus aureus. In adults, we can have bullous impetigo, or we can have burns. The burns can develop blisters, which is on the commonest, but it's not a disease. Burns is not a disease. And then pemphigus. Pemphigus is a bad disease. It causes blood blisters, which we have got another rubric. After blotches, we have got a rubric called blood blisters, wherein the only drug given here is arsenic. I would also add Bothrops and Elaps. And last time, we had distinguished between arsenic, Bothrops and Elaps, which medicine to give when. Of course, we get blood blisters, apart from pemphigus, in a disease called as idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, where it's rare. In ITP, you then generally get purpura, that is an enlarged blue-colored macule. But you can also get blood blisters occasionally. Then we had come to boils, and in boils, the three important drugs given here are kaliiode, sorinum, and sulfur. But I have distinguished between Hipparsulf and kaliiode. Hipparsulf should be used in the earlier stage of the boil, and I have given you a picture of a typical Hipparsulf boil. A typical Hipparsulf boil, and this reminds me of a case, a very beautiful case. He's still admitted in my hospital. 3 days ago, a gentleman aged around 70 years. He is a watchman in one of the institutes, and he's a known diabetic since past 7 to 8 years. Now, suddenly, he has stopped all anti-diabetic remedies. And about 7 days ago, he was bitten by a rat. In his night duties, he was bitten by a rat. And I don't know, 3 to 4 places the rat has bitten him. So next day, when this was at night, 7 to 8, 10 days ago, and he did not bother. That entire multiple wounds, two of them are on the chest, and 4 of them are on the legs. They got infected. He has got cellulitis, and the entire foot is swollen. He got high-grade fever, so he took a paracetamol from an allopathic pharmacy. The fever subsided, and then he continued for 7 to 10 days. After 10 days, he came to us in a very bad shape, very high-grade fever with multiple boils around the area of bite. And I asked him what is the reason for this negligence, and he could not reply. Anyway, so we admitted him, and he's still being hospitalized, and the boils typically resembled his Hipparsulf. So even before giving Hypericum, normally we give Hypericum for any bites, particularly rat bite, but then we had to give him Hipparsulf directly. And after giving Hipparsulf, the amount of pus that has drained, the fever also has reduced, and the pus also has reduced, and we are quite happy. Now today is the 4th day he is with us, and quite better. His appetite has returned. Urine and stool obviously were normal, but so that was not an issue. He was going in for septicemia had we not done anything about it. So Hipparsulf, suppuration, pricking pain, chapped skin, sensitive contact, more sweating, but still wants to be wrapped warmly, offensive with discharge. And then we have got Kali iode, which are small boils with yellow colored tip and hyperemia at the base. A very, very painful boil, Kali iode. Kali iode boil is a very painful this. Kali iode should be used before Hipparsal. Kali iode should be used a stage prior to Hipparsal, and once the mouth is there, once you know that the pustule is about to burst, then you can give Hipparsal. Then I've also given a pustule of sulfur, and you can see that in that picture of the there are multiple small boils, pustules at the base of the hair. These are nothing but furunculosis or a single carbuncle. Multiple boils together coalesce or connect with each other and form a big carbuncle. A carbuncle is a sure sign of diabetes. And the wonder drug here is sulfur. And we have got so many cases, numerous cases. You give hardly few doses of sulfur in 200 of 1 potency, and the entire carbuncle literally bursts, discharging a lot of pus. And the moment the pus is discharged, the patient feels relieved, the fever goes away, the patient, the appetite returns, the original behavior of the patient returns. So this is sulfur discharge. Then we also talked about desquamating eruptions. I told the audience that we have hardly used Lead-Impal in, but still it's 3-mark symptoms drug, so 2-mark drug. That's why, but this is the eruption of photograph of eruption of Lead-Impal. Then we have talked about eczema, wherein the different pictures are given for graphitis, for sulfur, for kalisulf and sorainum. We also discussed graphitis, sorainum and kalisulf in depth. We also discussed petroleum in depth, wherein a picture of petroleum is given with scattered papulo-ulcerative lesions, a deep red base, deep cracks in the skin, a very initial stage of sorainum or even eczema, and you have got petroleum on the this. So, we had discussed till eczema. The other rubrics remaining are herpes. The herpes, basically a viral infection. You can have two types of herpes. Herpes zona pellucida or herpes zoster, that is commonly called as shingles, wherein we use the drug given here is graphitis, lachesis and mesarium, of course. And this, the drug arsenic is given with intense burning pain, itching, restlessness, icy coldness of the body, and syphilinum, an unthought of drug in herpes. I mean, you would never think of giving syphilinum in acute stage of herpes. But then still, the eruptions of syphilinum are those reddish brown eruptions, pains from darkness to daylight, biting sensation as if bitten by bugs, aggravated by night only. Herpes again is a very, very important sign of a deteriorating immune status. Normally, in our practice, for the classical shingles, we use mesarium. It acts very well. Very, very rarely, we need to use arsenic. Of course, I have never used syphilinum in my practice. I never needed to use syphilinum. The maximum drug is, the mesarium does the job. Mesarium is an excellent remedy. It hardly takes, and I would tell you, the readers, herpes zoster, it starts initially with low-grade fever, and thus vesicles, or this herpetic vesicles, they begin. They take one dermatome, that is one nerve arising from the spinal cord, and then till the entire nerve is covered, the virus keeps on progressing, and you can have vesicles throughout one particular line. It may be on the chest, it may be anywhere in the body. And the most dangerous part is if it occurs in the eye or on the face. It's very, very painful. Anyway, but this is not... if it occurs on the chest, the commonest drug, first drug which we use is rhododendron. And once rhododendron is used, ranunculus bulbosus. Once ranunculus bulbosus does its job, what does it do? It decreases the intensity of the pain. It's a very, very painful phenomenon because the eruptions are occurring just above the nerve on the skin level. So ranunculus bulbosus, but still if it doesn't subside, and if there are vesicles, multiple vesicles, then we use cantharis, and if cantharis does not act, then mesarium does the job if it becomes pustular. So we have got herpes. If you have to use arsenic, then the vesicles have to be, I mean, there should not be any pus. It should be clear vesicles. If there's pus, then we use mesarium.
Today, shingles is much more common, and I think it has something to do with giving the vaccinations to young people and to older people. They're giving vaccines.
Yeah, they're giving vaccines, and that is why they're suppressing the chickenpox. Chickenpox, measles, etc., these are diseases. Well, I mean, I remember having read that I don't know exact place, but in Europe, lately, a few years ago, I read an article that they have started realizing and about the importance of not giving vaccine and the importance of why measles and chickenpox occur in childhood. And they have measles parties. That means if my child has got measles, I would invite all other children from the neighborhood so that they also get measles. So this was natural vaccination. Of course, pediatricians from the allopathic school, they would scorn to this idea of natural transmission of a viral disease like measles and chickenpox. But then this was there. And I mean, if once you get measles, once you get chickenpox, not all patients or all children go in for complications. They're very, very few apart. So nowadays, in today's times, we can definitely monitor those cases. Initially, it was there that we used to lose children because of the complications, but now it is not so. So basically, I mean, I don't adhere to the idea of suppressing chickenpox and measles by giving vaccines. Let the natural recourse take, disease take its course, and once these diseases occur, they restore, give immunity to many other small viruses, which we don't know.
Absolutely.
I have got measles and chickenpox, and I have been living a very healthy life. I mean, even children have got. So we don't do anything for those measles and chickenpox. Just monitor whenever those things come. And you're perfectly right. Because of these mass vaccinations, we are getting loads of cases of herpes zona pellucida or shingles.
And again, a bad
effect of vaccination, we have got drugs like mesarium. So again, mesarium serves both the purposes. Yeah, please go on.
Both purposes, yeah. I think that what happens is the physicians today, at least in America, in allopathy, instill a tremendous amount of fear in the hearts of the parents that the children could have a very bad effect, whether they would go blind or deaf or something would go wrong if they got the disease. And
it's not only in U.S., it's not only U.S., it's throughout the world. Throughout the world, the entire modern medicine, the pediatricians, they instill so much fear that the parents feel that it's better to give vaccinations, not 1-10, but those complications. It's not their parents' fault. It's the problem of outlook.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they just simply disagree with this idea that there can be something as bad effects of vaccination. Whenever you talk to a pediatrician about those bad effects of vaccination or the harms of vaccination, the entire topic is just overruled and it's just made a mockery of. So vaccination is taken as a face value and nothing is judged. I mean, referring to the article of New York Times, which you had sent me, and we were supposed to discuss it.
We can discuss it next time, if you know, next week or the week
after.
Yeah,
but then the article is about mice.
Yes.
Mice being used in allopathic trials.
Yes.
Throughout the world, for the first phase of trial, animal trials, white mice mice are used. But nowadays, we don't get white mice. So a study was conducted, I don't remember the place where it was, but a study was conducted wherein they found that many drugs, the trials for many drugs conducted on mice were not similar to those in human beings. So this was a startling revelation made by that study. Of course, I have yet
to me it is not startling. I have been blogging, saying often, are we mice?
No, to the allopaths. To the so-called scientists. For us, Luckily, Hahnemann has never wanted to do this sort of experiment on animals first and then to human beings. We were directly, and that to healthy human beings were selected for drug proving. So, not for us, but then yes, it was definitely a startling revelation for many of the colleagues. Even the moment you send me this email, I talked to one of my pediatrician friends and he said, no, it's not possible.
It is not possible for
such,
what?
Such studies keep on coming and such studies are not published. I mean, I have not come under any of this. And even if it is there, I said, why don't you pay hint? I mean, if someone is publishing, so they are not ready to take it on face value that there can be something like this.
It turns their science upside down and it refutes so many of the medicines and the procedures that they have been using, whereas homeopaths throughout the centuries have been doing provings on healthy individuals because we know that it's going to not cause any harm or damage to the person. But they have to go through millions and millions of dollars of research and development and give it at cellular level, to mice, killing mice and rabbits and monkeys, and then coming up to human trials where they find all kinds of side effects and problems with the drugs that they give. And so it's very difficult for them to, you know, conceive of this kind of thinking. The people who have written this article must have been very brave to make these statements, to say that the possibility that the mice models are not collaborating, they're not corroborating the effects in humans, that it does not transfer over.
They're not only brave, but they have stood their stand. I mean, they've taken the stand and they've stood by it. See, you can easily retract facing opposition, mass opposition. But they actually found the sanity to question, the basic sanity to question whether mice, the trials on mice really works. See, that is very important. You first question what you are doing. It's a question of faith, actually. I mean, you repose so much faith in your particular practice method, and then you start questioning and you realize that what you have been doing for such a long time may not be, after all, so much true.
Well, you mentioned faith, and that's how we started the show. You have to take a great leap of faith in order to come from the spot where you have been sitting in your belief system for so many decades, in your training, in the people who you've looked up to, in the literature that you have been reading, and then you have to look in another direction and say, you know, that the concept that this is not working properly is so far into me that I must take this leap of faith.
Exactly. Well, then coming out onto the next rubric, a sub-rubric of eruptions is miliary eruptions. Miliary eruptions are very, very small, tiny eruptions, and they are multiple in nature. They occur on the chest. And many say there is no specified reasons for miliary eruptions. Why do they occur? But they can be as a result of an allergy which is called as seborrheic dermatitis. Seborrhea or seborrheic dermatitis. It's a type of an eczema. It's an inborn eczema. And you generally get such type of multiple eruptions on the chest. The commonest drug which we use here is natrum muriaticum, which is not mentioned here. But what is mentioned is hydrocortile and mesarium. Hydrocortile is a drug which has got thick epidermis and exfoliation of the scales, circular spots, intolerable itching and profuse sweat. All this is very, very clearly seen in a disease was quite common in India, that is called leprosy or Hansen's disease. But hydrocortile and Hura are the drugs of choice for leprosy. But then miliary eruptions also, they maintain bare hydrocortile. I've never used hydrocortile and never had the need of using mesarium for miliary eruptions. These are constitutional disorders, rather a single symptom of a constitutional disorder, and that is seborrheic dermatitis. So just by suppressing these eruptions, you don't achieve anything. And normally, you have with miliary eruptions, you have a typical greasy skin, which is there in natrum muriaticum skin. So miliary eruptions, since hydrocortile was the drug, that's why I mentioned. then we have a very good sub-rubric called nodule. And we have got a lot of drugs, baryta carb, carboenamylase, hippozoin, Merck core, and natrum sulfuric, natrum sulf. I have given three pictures of nodule. A nodule is, as I said, it's an enlarged papule. It's a very firm to hard to stony hard eruption on the skin. But it's definitely more than 2 centimeters. It may enlarge to form a tumor that is more than 5 centimeters. So they are interchangeable words, nodule and tumor, but definitely they are firm to hard to very hard. Now, if you have got multiple nodules on the chest, a very, very common occurrence is called neurofibroma or neurofibromatosis, of which baryta carb is a very, very good remedy. And we have got, at least I've got 7 patients of baryta carb, I mean, who have responded to baryta carb. The number of nodules, the consistency, the definitely from the hardness, it has come to become firm, and from firm it has become to soft by using baryta carb. I normally give baryta carb in low potencies, 1x or 2x, for 2 or 3 months in people who have got neurofibromas or multiple nodules on the chest or wherever. I mean, so it's a very, very good remedy.
And what about something like conium or conium for a
heart? No, that doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
And conium doesn't have multiple nodules.
Okay.
1 or 2 nodules generally tending to become more malignant, a malignant melanoma for that matter. A malignant melanoma can occur on the chest, and it looks like, see the last, in the slide of nodule, the last picture which is there. Now this is a very, very plain looking, shiny nodule. A small nodule, or more resembling a tumor, and this would be a conium. It appears to be malignant on the face of it. Of course, we have not touched it. Therein, you can use carboenamylase as well as conium. But if a nodule starts paining, and there's a very peculiar disease, which I have got one patient, and in fact, yesterday only had come to me. He has got Durkheim's disease, D-E-R-C-U-M-S, Durkheim's disease. That is lipomatosis dolorosa, or painful lipid nodules. Lipomatosis dolorosa. Dolor means pain, and lipomatosis means generalized lipid nodules throughout the body, and they become very, very painful the moment he consumes gluten. That is chapatis or rotis or pancakes. Moment he has wheat, the entire day and night he has to suffer, and they become very painful. And for that, we have to give him Merck core.
Mercurius core.
A very, very good remedy for alleviating the pain in the nodules. The nodules don't go away, but the pain definitely subsides, and that's a very good drug. I don't believe that many people know about this, because very, very few people are aware of this condition of Durkheim's disease. A hereditary disease. But it's a very painful, it's a very annoying disease. In neurofibromatosis, you may have got multiple nodules. Cosmetically, you don't like it. That's fine. But suppose if the nodules start paining, it's a very bad feature. I mean, what do you do about it? Then you can give Merck core.
I want to let you know that we have a number of listeners today, and if anyone there has a comment or a question, we welcome you. There is a call-in number, 347-945-6956 in the United States. If you're out of the United States, then you have a blue Skype button to click on the page of Blog Talk Radio.
Then, bigger than nodules, another very, very common eruption for which multiple people come to us. I mean, initially, when I started my practice in cardiology, homeopathy cardiology, the patients of CABG used to come, and post bypass, they used to come to me. post CABG, they used to come to me. And I was very happy that they had come for heart, and they had not come for heart. They had come not for cardiac complaints, but they used to come for keloids, which were developing after the patient has undergone bypass on the area of the cut or the stitches or the wound. They used to get keloids. So I have several patients of keloids. This is one of my patients. The pictures which I have given of keloids, three babies, he has got keloids all over the body. I mean, all over means all over the body. So the first, the right and left ones, and I have enlarged one keloid which is so big. I had to give him Thuja. This gentleman was, is a highly psychotic man. And he is basically a Thuja person. So Thuja was given. And substantially the keloids have decreased in number. The center one, which is the keloids on chest, this is the pictures after Thuja has been given. So you can see the vast number of keloids. They are still there in the center picture, but they have been decreased to a great extent. And then I have, after two doses of this Thuja, I have put him on thiosinimum 3X, and he's continuing still dead. So the size of the keloids have decreased. I'm happy about it.
For those who are listening in, there is a link right on the show page that says presentation file. It will open up into a PDF file so that you can view these images with us.
Now, I've again given you a slide wherein you have got carboenamylase, Buraitaka, Pulsatilla, right side and left side remedies. Carboenamylase, the nodules of carboenamylase are generally bluish red in color. They are hard and they are painful. And basically, I would prefer carboenamylase if a nodule is there since a long time and suddenly it has started showing signs of becoming malignant, which can happen with squamous cell carcinoma or basal cell carcinoma, which are the two commonest malignancies, or a melanoma, which is the commonest malignancy of the skin, on the skin. So carboenamylase essentially becomes a very important remedy for malignancies, early malignancies of skin, particularly melanoma, which is changing its color. A junctional melanoma is bound to change its color and become malignant. And therein you can use carboenamylase. You have to use it in proper potency, that is moderate potency, start with 200. Or if you have got millisimil potency 0/1 or 0/2, at the most, you start it, repeat it as it is required, and you can definitely see a change. I have a case, only a single case, of using carboenamylase, an experience of using carboenamylase, and thereby decreasing that malignant change, and we have proved it by with biopsy. So we do have such cases of carboenamylase. Of course, the next rubric is pimples. I am sorry, I could only cover two or three slides in today's show. It's already 10 o'clock. So I wish to end here, and then tomorrow, next show, we would be covering pimples, pustules, rash, and other eruptions on the skin.
Okay. I really appreciate that you have taken the special time to be with us. It's been enlightening and informative. We learned a lot of things that we probably would never have known, and about the remedies. For those people who are tuning in, you can contact Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim at homeoacad.org. You can contact me at homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com. And send in your questions, send in your requests for what we should discuss. And we're going to be ending today's part.
Before ending, I have one remark.
Go ahead.
The next show, I will be dedicating it to my father, whose birthday falls on 18th of February, and to my mother, whose birthday also falls on 22nd of February. So the next show would be dedicated to them.
Marvelous. We're looking forward to that.
They are homeopaths in their own rights, wonderful homeopaths, and they are the people who have actually taught me what homeopathy is, and that is how we have been discussing and growing together in homeopathy. So they do deserve my special, the entire show should be dedicated to them. That's my belief.
That sounds good. Whatever you'd like to do. And we're going to continue for the second hour of the show with Dr. Chambro talking about pats and the skin as well. And so I'm going to put on a little bit of music to end the first section. And everybody go get a drink of water or whatever, and we'll be back. So thank you, Dr. Adil.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Join us on Thursday as we explore Pet Health and Homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck, and Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, author and homeopath Christina Chambro. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go!
We are live back with Dr. Christina Chambro talking about pets and homeopathy. Dr. Chambro, welcome.
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful. So tell us where people can find you. Besides on Homeopathy World Community, there is an entire section of the network that is dedicated to all of the shows that we have done in the past with archives of, I think we did something like 27 shows. So we're so happy to have you back again and talking with us about pet health.
Well, I'm glad to be here, as always, and we're following up with skin and skin eruptions. We might as well, even though we're not going to localize them just to the chest, as our cardiology specialist was doing, but he was really talking about skin eruptions in general. So I strongly, you know, very strongly recommend that anybody who's interested in eruptions in animals also listen to Dr. Adil's prior talk, and then he'll be talking next week on skin as well, because he teaches a lot of the meaning of the different words, like the size of a papule versus a pustule, what's in a pustule, what's in a vesicle. There's also a great website that gives definitions of those. So we're going to have, not quite sure, what do you want to do, Deb, in terms of, I've got a little bit
of visuals,
just a little bit of written. I'm going to email it to you.
Okay. Well, I think you should just start talking.
I will.
We'll follow.
I just emailed it to you, and then you can go. So,
okay.
How many people do we have online? Do we have anybody on the line?
Just you and me have called in, but we have a couple of guests. Dr. Adil might be listening, and another guest.
Okay. So here's the thing. What you want is we're going to talk in general about skin health for animals, and then we're going to move into looking at the repertory and then a little bit of materia medica. So we're sort of going to do this in three parts. So the first part is always in homeopathy, we always focus on the whole animal or the whole person. And if you think about it, skin, okay. How many dogs, cats, and people have you seen die from a primarily skin disease? Not very many. So skin, and according to Herring's Law, healing happens from the inside to the outside. And while the skin is a very important organ, I mean, if the skin's not functioning right, you really can absorb toxins, you could become ill in other ways. So it is an important organ, but in Herring's approach, it's considered healing from the more important organs to the lesser important organs. So for both inside to out and lesser important organs, the skin is considered a pretty good place to get your imbalance. How does illness happen in the first place? It's not because of something from the outside. It's because the vital force has been pushed out of balance or is born out of balance. Something has triggered it, and it wants to get better. For it to get better, it has to produce symptoms. So symptoms are produced by a triggered vital force, by an out-of-balance vital force. And that's what we want to remember, and that's the joy of homeopathy, is we're fixing the vital force. Once it's fixed, they're fixed for good. So when the vital force is stronger rather than weaker, it's going to keep the symptoms on the outside in spite of suppression, or it just won't allow itself to be suppressed. So an example of that is a cat who came to me at 9 years of age who'd been licking its belly raw. It was diagnosed as feline endocrine alopecia. And that basically means cat hair loss hormone. But the reason they called it hormone was because they'd used Ovaban, which was a birth control pill for dogs, and it seemed to stop the cats from itching. Of course, then they developed diabetes from it. So most veterinarians stopped using it after 10 or 20 years. So this cat had been given steroid injections, which was the other major treatment for feline endocrine alopecia.
And it took them 10 or 20 years to figure this out, huh?
Yeah, well, there were complications.
Okay.
So with this cat, started when it was about 2 years old licking its belly raw and got its first shot. And I saw it when it was 9 years old. It was now getting a steroid shot every 6 weeks. Now, each time it got the steroid shot, the itching would stop, the skin would clear up, and the hair would grow back. So at first it was once a year, then twice a year, then three times a year, and now it was getting a shot every 6 weeks. And the owner, who was a vegetarian, said, you know, there's got to be another approach. So she came to me as a homeopath. Now, the question that I want people to think about for a moment is, here's a cat that has been getting steroid injections. So a lot of people would go, oh, that cat's got to be pretty sick. The only symptom this cat was showing was a skin problem and a little bit of maybe being the boss of five cats in a townhouse. He would sometimes reach out and swat somebody, which may or may not have been a symptom. And there was very little else in terms of symptoms. So does this cat have a stronger vital force than the average or a lower vital force than the average?
And, of course, you're always asking me.
Because you're the one who's there.
Okay, so the cat has been able to throw out the symptoms and display it on the skin for the owner to see. So I would say, yes, this cat has a strong vital force that it's asking the owner for help.
And it's also a strong vital force. You're absolutely right. It's a strong vital force because even though the symptoms were stopped each time with steroids, the cat didn't give up and develop a more serious illness. So many animals and people treated with steroids, when the symptoms quickly go away, like they did in this cat, they then develop, the vital force says, okay, well, I can't get it out to the skin anymore. I guess I'll cause liver disease.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess I'll cause diabetes. Or I guess I'll, you know, it's just not strong enough to push it out. But this cat, for 9 years of steroid injections, or 8 years of steroid injections, still, man, he kept pushing it out to the outside, even doing it more frequently.
And his disposition also, was that changed or did that remain the same?
His disposition had been pretty much the same all along.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of if they are healthy enough to keep it on the skin, they're usually healthier overall. Now, this is not always true, for sure. But if your only problem is a skin problem, rejoice. Be happy. I remember a case that Paul Hirschke was treating. This was back in the 80s when I studied with him, or early 90s. And he had a man who had come to him with suicidal depression. And he treated him, and after a while, the suicidal depression was gone. And about 6 months later, the man developed severe eczema. And Paul said, well, let's just wait. And he kept seeing him once a month. And the man finally said, if you don't treat me, I'm going to go get steroids because I want to start dating again. I'm feeling great, but I'm embarrassed about my face. So Paul reluctantly treated him. The eczema went away in 2 hours, and the depression was back within 24 hours.
So does this mean that we're not supposed to try and relieve this eczema in any way?
No, it's not about not relieving it. You can use aloe vera. You can use Reiki, Tellington Touch, Healing Touch for animals, Rescue Remedy. There are many things that the man was doing. It didn't hurt him. It wasn't painful. He just didn't like the looks of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was too big, I guess, to hide with makeup.
Yes, especially, you know, if it's on your face, this is what you present to the world. So
exactly.
What but do you
the,
do?
The point was, and so then the guy came back to Paul and said, okay, I'm willing to have the skin problem. And
uh-huh.
So, you know, after about another 6 months or a year, the skin problem went away and the depression stayed away and the man was cured.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to be careful when you're treating skin symptoms. And expect them to go away in a reasonable amount of time. I have actually a very similar example with a dog. Dog came to me who'd been scratching and had bumps all over its body and hair loss for about 2 years. And they were holistic, so they'd tried some different herbs and flower essences and maybe antibiotics one time. They had not used steroids. And I prescribed to the best of my ability. There was nothing else to go on, just skin. So it's very difficult to treat skin conditions in animals when there's no other symptom. This dog had no modalities, no characteristic symptoms. So I did my best. I gave a remedy. 2 weeks later, when she calls back, she goes, Dr. Chambro, you're a miracle worker. And already I'm going, uh-oh, that doesn't sound good, because this dog had been scratching 2 years. And she said, within 2 hours of giving the remedy, within 5 minutes of giving the remedy, the dog stopped itching. And I went, uh-oh. So then I started asking her more. So what else is going on? And couldn't come up with anything, but I knew it was there. So I kept pushing. And finally she said, oh, I'm glad you asked again. She's been biting the children. So thinking about biting the children could be a good thing. If this dog had been so ill that the children were abusing her and she wasn't fighting back, then actually biting the children was a good thing. But it wasn't that. The kids were nice kids. The dog wasn't abused. It was that the remedy, the homeopathic remedy I gave, suppressed the skin and caused aggression to come up. Now, the remedy didn't cause the aggression. The remedy triggered the vital force to express something that was already in the vital force. And so when I re-repertorized, I included the aggression. And then the itching came back, the aggression went away, and over the next 2 months, the itching slowly went away with several repetitions of the remedy. So you do want to really, with animals, pay attention, just like you do with people, to cure, palliation, and suppression. And again, just like with people, you also have to ask the question, so how come we have this skin problem? Is it detoxing? Is it because of toxins in vaccines, toxins in drugs? Are we giving flea preventative that's a toxin instead of using natural flea preventative? Am I being as careful as I should in the house? Maybe I just moved into a brand new house that's outgassing, and I'm not sensitive to it, but my dog is. Sometimes we'll get dogs, especially that have belly rashes or cats, And after careful tracking and asking questions, we'll discover that they've started washing their bedding and they're using a new shampoo, or they bought new bedding. And so it's really a contact dermatitis. Whatever the cause is, you always want to decrease toxins in the diet for yourself, or toxins in the environment, whether it's the diet, the environment, the water, the electromagnetic. We need to do the best we can. And sometimes we don't know what's triggering it, and so the trigger may persist. But Hahnemann talks over and over again about removing obstacles to cure. So those are common obstacles to cure. Vaccines, the only vaccine any animal needs to get is rabies. That's following the law. It's good for life. It's a viral vaccine, but you need to follow the law. The other vaccines, some people choose not to give them at all and just treat if they become ill, or give them as a puppy, distemper and parvo, or panleukopenia to a cat, and then either repeat them at a year or not repeat them, and that's it. Those viral diseases, they're set for the rest of their life. Diet, I recommend feeding a wide variety of fresh foods. Feed what you're eating. So whether you cook it or don't cook it, whether you use supplements or don't use supplements, we want to get away from canned and dry food. And no cat should ever be on dry food. Skin problems.
What they call kibble?
Yes, kibble.
Kibble is the dry, and I've been reading about that, saying that there's adverse reactions.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Even conventional are now starting to say that. They're starting to say dry food is coming back to bite us.
Mm-hmm.
So skin is one of the areas that I find diet makes the biggest difference. If you go online and do searches for raw food diet, cats or dogs, skin problems, you'll see testimonial after testimonial where the skin cleared up or got significantly better, and then homeopathy or something else was needed. If a dog comes to me with a skin problem, no matter, you know, moderately severe to mild, if it's okay with the owner, I will start with a month of feeding a better diet and see what improves, along with some topical soothing things. But I won't necessarily jump right in for a remedy, because it's very difficult to find rubrics that really translate to the animal. Animal lesions, because they're under the hair, aren't as distinctive usually as what we see on people. And animals have often already rubbed them or scratched them, so we may not see the initial lesion, whereas with a person, if you don't see the initial lesion, as you start watching, you'll see new lesions appearing. But it does make it a little more difficult. So I find that when it's predominantly skin, I want to do supplements and diet and environment and anything to support the skin getting healthier, and then see what's left to treat. Now, if you can find some characteristic symptoms or some modalities, then you've got a chance. So let's move to the repertory. So those of you who are listening to this tape, or those of you who are online, if you pull out your Kent's repertory and go to the skin section, you'll see that it may be tricky to do this correlation from people to animals. So, for instance, if you had a dog that had lost all the hair between the front leg on the chest, for instance, would you go to skin hair loss? Would you go to chest hair loss? Where would you go to look up that rubric? Or a cat that has bald spots all over after giving birth? Where would you go to look up the loss of skin?
The loss of hair?
I mean the loss of hair, yep.
Okay, so...
any idea, Debbie?
Well, I always think hair falling is something that I'm thinking... if it would be, usually you think about head hair falling. So now it's loss of hair on other parts of the body. So,
but people, where do they have hair?
On their head.
On their head. And animals have hair all over.
Right.
So it's definite. So you're absolutely right that no matter where, whether it's bald spots all over or whether it's hair between the front legs on the chest or whether it's hair on the head or the tail or the feet, wherever the hair loss is, you go to head hair.
Oh, good.
You were right on. So you go to head hair balling.
Okay.
And then you'll even find head hair falling after parturition for the cat who lost hair in spots.
Okay.
And then, of course, another thing is if you're working with animals, you'll know the animal diseases. And then you have to take the animal disease word and translate it into the repertory.
Right, so, because they wouldn't typically think of hair fall. We don't say hair falling. We say hair loss.
Right, exactly.
Or alopecia.
Right. But more importantly would be a word like anhidrosis. So horses have this very serious condition where they're not able to sweat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called anhidrosis. And so you need to know what that means, what the condition is, in order to look up the rubric for it.
And you also have to understand that parturition means after you've given birth.
Right, but that's pretty common. That's a human phrase as well.
Right.
So anhidrosis, maybe it's used, but...
anhidrosis, okay.
Right, and that's the specific condition in horses that's a very severe problem. And what it causes is the skin to be very, very dry. So where you find that rubric is under skin, dry, inability to perspire. So there's a sub-rubric, inability to perspire, under dry skin.
Okay.
Easier would be a dog with bleeding eruptions would be just like a person with bleeding eruptions. You'd go to eruptions, bleeding. And eruptions is the word, one of the words for bumps. Now, here's another one that you'd have to page through. You'd have to first decide whether you're going to find this in the generality section or in the skin section. If you have dogs or cats who get more fleas than other animals that they're around. So they just seem to be like some people are mosquito magnets.
Yeah.
Some dogs seem to be flea magnets. Now, in general, a healthy dog or cat will not get fleas. Healthy horses don't get flies, or they don't get them as much. And they aren't affected by them. So one clue there is if they get fleas, they're not well. But in terms of a rubric for that, there actually is a specific rubric in the skin section for people that tend to get head lice a lot. So it's called skin lousiness.
Mm-hmm.
So now this would take a lot of looking. You'd have to pretty much page through the whole section because you'd be looking for under the skin, you'd be looking for fleas or ticks or bugs or, it might take you a while to land on the lousiness rubric, right?
Unless we're listening to you.
Well, yeah, but they're going to, you can't, it would take, just like it was...
Mm-hmm.
Taking Dr. Abdil so long to go through the skin section, and he's speaking very, very fast. The same thing here. You can't learn it all from a person. You need to have a way of working with the repertory that makes it easier for you. And unfortunately, the index, while it's sometimes useful in Kent, is not always useful. So what I suggest if you're working with animals is that you sit down with your repertory and you go through every single section. And you look for the rubrics that you think you would see in animals. And you make a list of the rubric name, not all the remedies associated with it. And you may or may not include some of the sub-rubrics. So, for instance, in the skin section in the repertory, the first rubric is adherent. Well, first off, what's adherent?
That's
so then you have
to go
look that up and figure out what that is. And skin adherent to bone? ugh, that sounds pretty bad. So I don't think.
Where are you reading Skin Adherent to Bone?
1303.
I'm looking at 1303. Oh yeah, it does the subrubric to bone.
Uh huh.
Oh wow.
So you know, but adherent could refer to scarring. So you might want to put that down. Then the next rubric is anesthesia. Well, I had to look up anesthesia. I thought it meant numbness, but there's a separate rubric for numbness. It turns out there's a whole thing about leprosy related to anesthesia. So animals don't have leprosy, so we're not going to do anesthesia. Biting. For any of the skin sensations, it feels like I'm getting bites on my skin is skin biting. You can't use that with animals. The animals would have to tell you. And
unless they're biting themselves.
No, that's not, that, because animals have only two ways to deal with an itch. So how would you know if a dog is biting himself, if he has a biting sensation in the skin, a burning sensation in the skin, or just an itching sensation in the skin? You wouldn't know that. So biting doesn't mean biting yourself. Biting means a biting sensation, a biting feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't use that. So then you go to blotches, bran-like, all those, they go somewhere else. Bruised pain is another one. Someone could tell you their skin feels bruised. There's actually diseases in people where people feel like their skin feels bruised. But you're not going to get that with animals. Bubbling sensation, you won't have that. Burning, you won't have. So see how much of the repertory we're not going to have to look at. We're just going to have a little list. Right now it just has adherent on it.
Mm-hmm.
So far. And we've done a whole page of the repertory, and we only have one word. So that's going to make it faster to find things. So on the next page, 1304, we get chapping. We could use chapping, not something that we really see so much with dogs and cats. It could be like thickened pads, but then there's a word thicken. So if you want to, you put it down. If you don't, you don't. Now, cicatrices, you'd go, well, what's a cicatrix? So you'd have to look that up. And
mm-hmm.
Do you know, Deb?
No, I have to look that. I forgot.
It's a scab.
A scab, okay.
Yep, or a scar, sorry. It's a scar.
Okay.
So this definitely you want to have on your list for animals. So you want to have cicatrices. And you might want to add a couple of the sub-rubrics that are unusual, like cicatrices break open. I had a cat who presented to me who somehow injured, got a cut on its neck, been in a fight, I guess. And it had this wound on its neck that they'd gone to the conventional vet. They sewed it up. They put him on antibiotics. And 2 weeks later, it broke open again. It had healed, and it broke open again. And the next time they cut it open, they said that there was certain kind of scar tissue in there that would make it harder to heal. So they took a big chunk of neck out and sewed it up. And then on the other side of the neck, the skin just by itself broke open, and that's when they called me. So that was the rubric, cicatrices break open. And Cilicia, which is in that rubric, was the one that eventually cured the cat.
So the definition for
cicatrix.
Cicatrix. Oh, it sounds like a cereal
it's a box.
Bar. It's a new tissue that forms over a wound.
No. It's just a scar. There are multiple different cicatrices.
Okay.
But it is usually from a wound. But it could be from a surgery, not necessarily a wound.
Okay.
It could be, so I'd say injury or surgery. I guess surgery is an injury to the skin.
Right.
But the main thing is it's a scar.
So you can actually see the formation of this after the injury.
Well, you may or may not. Sometimes a scar usually leaves a sort of thickened and raised area. But sometimes the scarring is still internal and you don't see it, like when wounds from surgery are healing. There's scarring happening, but it hasn't, you know, made it bigger. So even when that breaks open, you'd think about it, there's probably a scarring breaking open. Mm-hmm. Then you have things like cicatrices become painful. So you could have an animal that had a wound and had a scar. Maybe it had one of those ear hematomas. They did surgery and it was, you know, sort of had some puckering on the inside but didn't cause any problem. Then all of a sudden it becomes painful or it becomes red. So that would be cicatrices become painful, cicatrices become red.
Mm-hmm.
So I would add those to as sub-rubrics.
And maybe the animal, let's say it is a dog, might start whining or moaning, indicating that it is painful to that animal.
It might. Usually something is localized like that. They would be more likely to, when you touch it, to yelp or pull away.
Okay.
And then coldness, you can certainly feel coldness in the animal's body. And then some of the sub-rubrics would be useful under coldness, like icy coldness and some of the others. So you get the idea of going through the repertory and then seeing what's going to fit for animals. So then you have this little tiny list when you have something to look up and you go, oh, it might be that. But it's much faster than paging through all of the pages of the repertory. When you're online, you can do it by a search function, but when you're actually in the field and using it with your hands, this makes it much quicker. When people take my week-long course, which actually we're going to be teaching this May in British Columbia, I'll have it on my website soon, but anybody who wants to really learn homeopathy will be doing a day of case-taking, a day of repertorization, a day of case analysis, potency selection and frequency, a day of evaluation of response, and a day of reviewing it all by using the cases that the people have brought to the class.
Mm-hmm.
And then for those of you who are already homeopaths and know those basics, the second week is going to be an advanced 5 days where we're going to be talking about, you know, how to take what you already know and use it with animals, or using, we'll go through the basic format, but we'll be using people's cases that they're stuck with and working with their questions, and how, at a deeper level, how do you look at miasms with animals, et cetera. And that'll all be in Vancouver, British Columbia, the last few weeks in May.
And how can people contact you about this?
They can come to my website, which is My Healthy Animals. That should be back up again.
I'll have to change it because right now I think I have...
You can keep it with Christina Chambrow.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I just when I say it, because it's My Healthy Animals is not up yet. It was supposed to be, but it's not. ChristinaChambrow.com is always the safe one to go to.
Okay, great.
It'll be on my calendar soon. I'll get it there in the next couple of days. So now, if we keep going through the repertory,
can I interject just something of curiosity?
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about this cicatrices, I found an article. I don't know whether it's not PubMed, but it says they did a study of the effect of UV irradiation on cutaneous cicatrices. It was a randomized controlled trial with the skin and skin reflective and all of these evaluations, and they came to a conclusion that the first human study to examine the effects of UV exposure on cicatrices after dermatological surgery. So they know that scarring does occur after surgery. This randomized control study shows that post-operative sun exposure aggravates the clinical appearance of young cicatrices in humans. This was done. And so that they recommend that wounds and cicatrices should not be exposed to sunlight during the post-operative wound healing period. And I imagine that would also apply to your pets.
I'm sure it would. Now, the other thing, though, as a homeopath, what pops in my mind is, would be for people who constitutionally are aggravated by the sunlight.
Ah.
Not for everybody. In conventional medicine, we do a every time we do anything, it's for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that's not true. So if you're a person who's in the past ever had problems with sunlight, you always have to wear sunglasses or you get a headache, or you always have to wear sunglasses because the sun bothers your eyes. You burn easily. You know, if you have a history of having problems that are worse from the sunlight or getting hot, well, worse from the sunlight, then you particularly would want to avoid the sun.
Uh-huh.
After a wound. See, that's the joy of homeopathy and Chinese medicine and other holistic approaches, is that we're looking at who we are as individuals, not who we are as species.
And you know, it's interesting because, you know, you have different thoughts that come in your mind when you read these kinds of articles. And I'm thinking of things like Sol, the homeopathic remedy of the sun, which has been used for healing skin problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thinking of the fact that they used UV exposure, radiation. So would
right.
we, you know, things like radium bromatum, the homeopathic remedy that would be having the essence of radiation. So I these are just,
again, that would be isopathy.
Yes.
Unless the person fit the characteristics of the provings of soul or the provings of the radiation.
Okay.
So you have to be careful to not jump immediately to that. You know, we do use that. I mean, in terms of skin problems, for instance, I know Dr. Tekert, who is the founder of the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association, he had a case of a skin, really severe skin problem in a cat, and he tried every different modalities. He tried homeopathy as best he could, not a lot of symptoms, but, you know, he did his best. And finally, over and over again, as he talked with the client kept saying, well, remember it happened right after that dip. So
uh-huh.
he found out what the dip was made from, had a remedy made from that dip, gave it to the cat, and it significantly improved the cat. It got rid of that obstacle, and then with other treatment, the cat went on to heal.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a place for doing that sometimes, even if it doesn't match.
Yeah, because I was looking under this section of cicatrices for any of the remedies that I just mentioned, and they're not listed. So,
well, Soul wouldn't be in Kent.
Oh.
Because it
yeah.
wasn't. It's a modern remedy. Remember, if
okay.
you're using Kent, you're looking at only the remedies that were there in 1900.
Okay.
So that's why. And the radiobromatum wouldn't be there either. So neither of those would be there. But as you see, if you just sort of scan that, what pops out at you? Silica, lacuses, phosphorus, graffitis.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
those are very common remedies we'll talk about in a few minutes that are useful for skin problems.
Okay.
So you see the usefulness of going through the repertory. And if you don't know what a word means, you look it up. Remember, Yasgur's Medical Dictionary is great, or the wonderful Internet is great to just Google it. And then you want to, even if you think it doesn't fit, be sure you look at the subrubrics, because you might come across an interesting subrubric, like dry inability to perspire. And you go, oh, wow. If you're a horse person, you go, wow, that's anhidrosis. That's important.
Mm-hmm.
And so things like eruptions, I'm going to just mention one or two because I want to get on to the remedies. So the whole section of eruptions, some of them are useful of the sub-rubric, some are not. Erysipelas would be really good for pigs because they get erysipelas, actually. Then we have excrescences, which is sort of the lumpy, bumpy stuff. So those are warts and moles and just lumpy bumpies, you look under excrescences. And flabbiness of the skin, you definitely see that in animals. Formication. Formication means the sensation as if ants were crawling over your skin. Because ants produce formic acid, very acrid substance. So that's not a rubric you would have listed for animals, although you might want to think about it when some of these cats that you touch and their backs just ripple.
Yeah.
Almost as if they had ants crawling all over them. But it's still that you can't really use it because it only fits when somebody says, I feel like I have ants crawling all over me. And people will say that. Now, freckles. Do I want to teach you how to
Can
think?
I? What sure. about, you know, you know when you have, you get tickled by a feather that goes across your skin? Would that be a similar thing to the ants crawling on your skin if somebody said something like that?
Yes, it feels as if somebody's touching a feather to my skin. That would probably fit formication, too.
Okay.
So I'm teaching you sort of how to think as we go about this. So here comes the rubric freckles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a minute. Why is there a rubric for freckles? When people are born with freckles, you want to get rid of them? I mean, some people want to get rid of them.
Yeah, they do. They put lemon juice on.
Right. Other people like their freckles because they think they're cute.
Uh-huh.
So that's just a preference. But is freckles something you would think of getting rid of?
Well, not necessarily.
Right. You were going to say it. Go ahead. If they what?
The sun, or they change in any way, then you need to keep an eye on them?
Well, that's the point. If all of a sudden you get a bunch more freckles, and how we see this in animals is in older cats, particularly yellow cats, we see blotches that look just like freckles, and they are usually between the eye and the ear in that area that doesn't have a lot of hair.
Yeah.
And you'll see it around their lips.
Uh-huh.
So there are actually several things you can use for that. You can use skin discoloration, brown liver spots, because you know that those spots appear on people, and they're sort of like that. They look like freckles. And then the next sub-rubric is skin discoloration, dark spots in old people. And usually it's in older cats. As they age, it happens. And what happens when you find and then you use the rubric freckles. When you find the similimum for the animal, those new spots will go away, but the original freckles stay.
Mm-hmm.
So usually these cats had some to start with, and then they develop more. And usually something else is going on, because very, very rarely is somebody going to look at seeing more freckles and go, I need to see a vet, or I need to go to a homeopath, or I need to treat these. Unless they're looking at the early warning signs of internal imbalance, which is on my website and on the ABH website, and I think it's on our website here of Homeopathy World Community from a prior talk. And if they're looking at the early warning signs, then they see freckles on the list, old dark spots appearing as cats age, and then they would know, oh, I should treat that. But it doesn't mean you're going to treat the freckles separate from anything else that's going on. Another one, just because we see it a lot, is if you go to itching, scratch until it must bleed, or itching, scratch until it is raw, which is on 1328. Those are useful rubrics because we do see that a lot. We'll see some animals scratch and scratch, but nothing happens, and others scratch and scratch, and as soon as it gets raw or bleeds, they stop scratching.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I do with mosquito bites. I scratch them until they bleed, and as soon as they bleed, I stop scratching them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very useful rubric. And then we come to, remember we talked about lousiness? So there's the lousiness rubric on 1330.
Yes.
And then we have swelling, a lot of swelling, ulcers. You wouldn't use ulcerative pain, but you would use ulcers. And there's a word that is a medical word, but it shows up a lot in the homeopathic repertory and write-up on remedies, Materia Medica, on 1337, is ulcers phagedenic. And phagedenic means spreading, getting larger and larger, just sort of spreading out like a blob of water that you drop on a table. So does that give a good sense of how to work with? And remember, if you have that short list, you may have only 40 or 50 words to look at instead of all these pages.
Yes, it seems like we have been going over the chest chapter and all of the rubrics with Dr. Adil for a year. And we're still only at the E.
At the E's.
At the E's.
Yes.
So it does take a lot of time to go through it all, and in that time you can learn quite a bit.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So this is a way of creating your own animal repertory.
It sounds great.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about a few of the remedies that are commonly used with skin problems for animals. So one of the most common skin remedies for people is sulfur. Common one in animals as well. And often that's what we'll finish a case with. So they can be ill with serious disease, and then finally they develop some skin problems and they prefer to be cold, and things about them smell and discharges, stool, and we use sulfur and that completes the case. The cat who was licking its belly raw, because there wasn't a lot of other ailments, I went through several remedies that didn't do anything and finally did sulfur, and sulfur finished the case. And the cat, by 10 years of age, all the hair had grown back. The cat lived to be 17 and never, ever licked itself raw again and never needed another dose of a remedy. So sulfur was the final one for that cat. And then all of these, you're looking at the whole animal, remember. So Arsenicum album has characteristics for the skin, but then it also has the general characteristics of being chilly and being fastidious, cleaning themselves a lot, not wanting to get dirty, piling their toys in a pile instead of spreading them all over the place.
Wow.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
Well, I've definitely seen it now. You don't know for sure with dogs if it's because they're fastidious or if it's because they're, I can't think of the word.
Collecting stuff like
that.
Yeah,
not a hoarder, but more possessive. That's the word I want.
Uh-huh.
So it could be possessive, keeping them away from others, or it could be being neat. But there are dogs that just are neat. If you think about it, poodles tend to be neat. If you think, like, which species is a neat dog? A poodle walks like they're wanting to be tidy. That doesn't mean they all need arsenicum. And, golden retrievers and labs swim, roll in the mud, shake themselves all over you.
Uh-huh.
So they're more likely to be on towards the sulfur side. But the arsenicum album, the key with that is there's often acrid discharges from the pimples or from the skin, and so that makes things raw. The keynote of arsenicum is they're worse in the middle of the night, midnight to 2 in the morning, so that owners are going to be awakened in the night by the animal scratching. However, you have to be really careful with that, because in life, here we are. We're rushing through our day. Maybe even we have our business at home, so our dogs are with us all the time. And oh, yeah, he's scratching. Oh, I'm busy, busy, busy. Oh, yeah, he's scratching. Oh, I'm busy, busy, busy. Oh, yeah, he's scratching. And now you're calm and you're asleep, and he's scratching no worse than he was when you were busy, but now you're trying to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell the homeopath he only scratches at night.
Mm-hmm.
But really it was that you just weren't really paying attention during the day. So the homeopath has to dig a little bit and actually maybe ask them to observe very carefully for 2 days and put a penny in a pile every time you see him scratch. Put a paper clip in a pile every time you see him scratch, something like that. And arsenicum in general, they prefer heat. They're pretty chilly animals. So you're going to see the skin characteristics, but you're also going to see the modalities. A really common skin remedy is graffitis. This is particularly for the heavy-set animals, the sort of overweight animals, the animals who, they don't want to get up and get going in the morning, but, you get them up, you get them out the door. Oh, I'm moving. Oh, hey, this is a pretty cool day. Hey, let's go for a 5-hour walk.
Really?
Yeah. So once they get moving, they're feeling pretty good.
Wow.
Now, some of them, of course, won't, but it's the sort of, it's not the Rustox kind of thing. It's just more, it's like they're phlegmatic and sluggish, but once they're moving, the body juices are sort of moving in them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, same thing for people as well. And so graffitis, the key of graffitis is honey-colored discharges.
Mm-hmm.
So graffitis is hot spots. Graffitis is interdigital pyoderma, infection between the toes, where it's usually just gooey and oopy and smelly and sort of like. And or they may get it in the crease of their elbows or right behind the ears where the ear hooks onto the head. You'll see mm-hmm. it right along that crease. So the graffitis is often in creased areas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gooey. Graffitis is gooey, and that's the biggest thing you want to sort of see with graffitis. Not that you couldn't use it for other things. And
mm-hmm.
then...
I think that you... Do we look it up, bends of joints?
Well, let's see.
I don't remember, but it just came to my mind about that. When you say the crease, how it would be...
mm-hmm.
I think you would look under maybe extremity or...
It's not under bends. It's not under extremities bends.
Oh.
I just looked. I think you'd have to go to maybe elbow...
Yeah, elbow.
You'd
probably
have to go to the bending joints. And so that means you'd have to go to the condition of either eruption or discharges.
Okay, I found extremities, cracking, joints bending on. No, that's not it. That would be, eruptions. Extremities, eruptions, joints, bends. And
there you go. Excellent.
Yeah, so that's it.
And was graffitis there?
There are. I'm looking at the complete.
What page?
I'm not looking at.
Oh.
I did a quick search. So the quicker the search is my complete dynamics computer program, and there are 83 remedies there. Graffitis is
okay.
There.
Okay. And if I do, for instance, page 991 in Kent, extremities, eruption, elbow, bend of. There's about 20 remedies in graffitis is there. Graffitis, sulfur, serinum, which we'll talk about,
mm-hmm.
Mesurium, which we'll talk about. So a lot of them are there.
Yeah.
And
yep, I see it.
Yeah. So it's definitely there. Good. That was great looking. You're good with you definitely are very good with the repertory. So another remedy that's good for the skin is Heparsulf. And again, so Heparsulf is... Okay, graffitis is just oozy. It can be infected, but the idea behind idea behind graffitis is sort of this oozy, cracky, cracks, thickened, oozy kind of thing. Heparsulf is infection. Heparsulf is abscesses. Heparsulf is a pustule. Heparsulf is, you know, it's more contained. They can go on to being a boil. It could open up. It could be what looks like it might be a graffitis could have been a Heparsulf initially. But the main difference is Heparsulf, and I love how Roger Morrison talks about Heparsulf. He says that Heparsulf is so sensitive to everything. That's why they're angry. We think of Heparsulf as being nasty. They're nasty because they're sensitive. So they're super sensitive to pain. So their pustules and pimples and open, oozy things are going to be very painful. They're sensitive to external stimuli like touch or even blowing. If you blew on the abscess or blew on the area that was affected on the skin, they would flinch. They really don't even want to be touched. It's sort of like arnica not wanting to be touched because of the pain. And they're more chilly than arsenicum.
I can't believe it, but our hour...
is up.
All of a sudden, it came upon us, so...
But that's good. We've really gone through the major other remedies is serinum, mesurium, which we just mentioned, petroleum, sepia for the hair loss, less skin and more hair loss and endocrine stuff, apis and ledum. Remember ledum for itching when you don't have anything else to go on and a very itchy dog, especially from flea bites or insect bites, then you want to think of ledum. So we really got through everything that was on the handout I emailed you.
Awesome. So we're going to pick this up next week.
Next week or next month? Are we doing it once a week?
Oh, I apologize. Next month. And I will announce the date to the folks.
Great.
It's the second Wednesday of the month.
So that would be the 14th. No, I'm sorry. I'm in the wrong calendar. That was last year's calendar. So it will be March 13th.
Yes, March 13th.
Okey-dokey.
And today is February 13th. So I thank you so much. And
you're so welcome. Thanks for all you do.
Okay, see you next time, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Pet Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopaths Debbie Brook and Dr. Christina Chambreau. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when show airs, share with friends on Facebook and Twitter, and send in your comments and questions. See you next time!